I don't know if it's still on, but any of you remember the show Undercover Boss? I think it was on ABC. I see some heads nodding. Do you know what I'm talking about? It was this show where they would grab a high-ranking CEO or the president or the CFO of some company, like Walmart, something big, right? And they would take that person and put them at, I think, the lowest rung humanly possible in the company organization, right? And they would go through about three of these different positions, and the boss would be trained by the employee. And they would go about their business generally messing it up in just like the best ways humanly possible, right? Just flubbing every step along the way, learning what it meant to be in their employees' shoes. And then there was always this moment where generally these heartfelt moments between the boss and the employee, where the boss got to know them a little better. Sometimes it wasn't to the employee's advantage. They needed more training to do the job they were in, really. But other times, the boss got to hear about their struggles, about their joys, about their concerns. And at the end of the episode, after it was revealed that this had been their boss the entire time, the boss often went out of his or her way to care for that person. But I absolutely loved that moment before it, right? It's this quintessential, it's the crux of the episode. It comes about three quarters through every time, right? Right at the climax, when the boss either removes the mustache and glasses or takes off the wig to reveal who they really are to the employee. And the look on their face is just absolutely dumbfounded each and every time to learn that this had been their boss. I like to think that this morning's gospel text seems to unfold for us much like an episode of this show. We can call it Undercover Messiah, yeah? As things play out in this episode, last week's text served as the setup for us. Remember how in it, Jesus asks disciples who those around him think that he is. After saying that many understand him to be a prophet akin to Elijah or Jeremiah or even John the Baptist, it's ultimately Peter who steps up to make the confession that Jesus is in fact the Messiah, the Son of the living God. It's the confession that Jesus praises Peter for. It's that confession upon which Jesus says he will build his church. Yet after all of this, Matthew, the gospel writer, leads us to the enigmatic moment when Jesus tells the disciples that even now, after recognizing the reality of who he is, they are not to tell anyone that he is the Messiah. Which brings us to today. After swearing the disciples' secrecy about who he is, Jesus makes the single greatest revelation about his messianic identity. It's a revelation that apparently comes to the disciples straight out of right field. It's one that doesn't make sense. It doesn't line up with their understandings of what this Messiah is supposed to do. See, this whole time, they'd been hoping for a Messiah who would come to free them and to restore Israel to the order and magnitude it once held. They were looking for the rebel Messiah who would come in and throw out the Romans and free the Jewish people from the military occupation taking place in their homeland. After all, they had tried such rebellions on their own in the past. They'd tried to usher in their own deliverance, but it never took. The Romans always managed to put down such insurrection. But with the Messiah, no one would be able to stop that rebellion. No one would be able to stop God's chosen from restoring God's order. This was their hope for the Messiah. It's probably the hope of many of Jesus' disciples and almost certainly the hope of Peter as well. Which is why Jesus' words come as such a shock to all of them this morning. After confirming in last week's text that he was, in fact, this one for whom they'd been waiting all this time, today he adds a piece to the story that simply does not line up with the narrative the disciples have in mind. Jesus shows them, as Matthew writes, that he and his disciples must go to Jerusalem And there he will undergo great sufferings at the hands of the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed. Let's be honest. Such a foreboding image. Such a dismaying outlook. This is not what you want to hear from the person on whom you've staked your entire life's claim. It's demoralizing to hear that the one in whom you've placed your entire hope, the one whom you left everything for, is now going to be killed. What's more is that the scandal of this statement is that the disciples' Messiah is apparently going to be killed by their own religious leaders. For him to die maybe by the Romans, well, that seems less than desirable, but it was certainly understandable. But to predict a death coming at the hands of those who should most vehemently be supporting God's chosen one, that's downright unacceptable. So Peter tells Jesus as much. He takes Jesus aside and begins to rebuke him, saying, "God forbid it, Lord. This must never happen to you. Surely Jesus won't let the ones with whom he'd been theologically struggling throughout his ministry get the last word here. Surely he won't let these religious authorities snuff out his voice once and for all. God forbid it. This can't be the end to what you've started here." Peter is understandably scandalized by what he hears, just as we should be, because it is scandalous, this projection of his. Yet rather than comfort him in his sense of dismay, Jesus' words to Peter scold him for his misguided understanding. "Get behind me, Satan," Jesus exclaims. "You are a stumbling block to me. Don't stand in my way. Don't you see? This has to happen." Peter's worry over his Messiah's well-being, despite coming from a place of earnest concern, misses the bigger picture. Jesus must make his way to the cross. There's simply no other way about it. This path towards Jerusalem is the only route for him. Anything that would take Jesus off this path is for him a stumbling block, a distraction, a product of Satan, the accuser himself. This is the shock of our undercover Messiah. Jesus knows what is waiting for him in the holy city, and he knows he needs to be there. If Peter had heard through his pain, maybe he would have heard the extra note, though. If we can hear through our own brokenness, through our own misguided understandings of what the Messiah is, perhaps we can hear it as well. Matthew writes that from that time on, Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and undergo great suffering at the hands of the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed, and on the third day be raised. See, this road that leads to Golgotha, this road that leads to the cross, it's the same road that leads to Jesus' resurrection as well. That's the surprise of this Messiah. It shouldn't shock us that a Messiah with a message like Jesus's would be put to death. What should surprise us is the fact that in open defiance to the power of death itself and the oppression of those who wield it, new life is what gets the final word. This is why Jesus must make his way to Jerusalem. Jesus' identity as the Messiah, the Son of the living God. That confession made evidence by Peter last week, it's an identity that is incomplete without his experience of suffering and death. He needs to come to know them both firsthand. He needs to make his way to the cross. Just the same, however, we, as children of God and made heirs through Jesus himself, we are incomplete without his resurrection. While it may be the image of the cross that looms in our minds as we look to a world full of brokenness and pain, it is ultimately the empty tomb that calls out to us with a promise that these products of our own failures and shortcomings will not have the last word. Jesus' resurrection continues to guarantee the promise of the living God's life eternal for you and for me. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. When Jesus scolds Peter, he uses words that Peter has already heard from him. In Matthew's written Greek, Jesus' scolding words of "get behind me" are the same words as Jesus' invitation to Peter: "Follow me." Perhaps then his words serve as that same invitation today. "Follow me to the cross," Jesus says. "Put behind me all of your brokenness, all of your misconceptions, all of your failures, all of your old creatures, all of that which would cause you to stumble along the way. Put them behind me and follow me to the place where I will put them to death with me. Instead, I will return to you the new life found in this living God." Jesus calls us to lose our lives for his sake, and in turn find lives worth living. So let them go. This undercover Messiah has already died the only death worth fearing for you. What's left can only be a new life found worth living, both for and in him. Amen.